The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Monday afternoon. How are you? If you want to contact the programme, the text number is 51551 and our email address is ray@rte.ie. Now, you might want to ask a number of people we have on after 4 o'clock questions, because we have somebody who's an expert on waste. What do you put in your black bin and your brown bin and your green bin? And of course, that's only if you're in Dublin. I believe there are blue bins and other types of bins down the country. We have somebody who's an expert on electricity and how you can save electricity. And we have a lady who's an expert on water. They're all in after 4 o'clock. And I suppose they'll be asking the question of you, how sustainable are you? So if you want to improve your sustainability in this week, which is Climate Action Week on RTE, you might get your questions in now. We'll be adding to our carbon footprint during the week because we're heading down to Cork for the show on Wednesday. And we're there for the second heat in our Stand Up and Be Funny competition. We were in Bray last week and we'll be in Galway in a few weeks' time. But the city limits in Cork is where we'll be on Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock. And we'll be inviting and introducing six aspiring comedians. And they will battle it out. One will be chosen and that person will go forward to appear on the television on the 7th of December. So we will have three finalists from Bray and Cork and Galway, and then we have a wild card as well, and we tell you how you can vote for them. So we're looking forward to that. City Limits on Wednesday, and if you're around, you can come along and say hello. Now, last Wednesday on the programme, I think it was Wednesday, wasn't it? We had Dara Smith and Stephanie Starpung on, and I'll tell you the story again just in case you didn't hear it. Dara was playing the piano in Connolly Station last Friday week, and he had his eyes closed and he was singing a song, Say Something, and he was going at it and sounding brilliant. And next thing, up behind him comes Stephanie, who was returning from a gig in UCD, and she sang along with him. Now, she only knew the chorus, so he was turned around, complimented her on her singing voice, and she went off with her friends. And you would think never to see her again, but it went viral, the video did, and then our Niamh got in touch with both of them, got them back together, got them into studio here. Great reaction last Wednesday on the radio. Then we brought them onto the telly on Saturday. Huge reaction, huge reaction. I see Dara is actually trending now on Google searches. And a lot of people are suggesting that maybe their duet of Say Something could be a Christmas number one. Coincidentally, on Saturday night on the telly, we gave them a voucher for Temple Lane Studios, a 6-hour session where they can go in and record their version of that song. And people were saying, well, you should put it out for charity for Christmas. Now, there was a time when I knew everything about doing that, but I have to make a few phone calls, made a few already today to see if it's possible. You know, the lead-in time and all that sort of thing, but you can put it up. We'll see anyway, we'll see. And we have to talk to Dara and Stephanie as well to see if they want to do that. So that's very exciting times, very exciting times. And it was just one of those moments. And you don't get them that often these days. But they went over to the baby grand piano and we were all dumbstruck, the audience in the studio and myself. And it just, you just realise that you're witnessing something very special, because these were two people who were complete strangers 8 days previously, and there they were on national television doing a beautiful version of a beautiful song. Anyway, that's that. We'll keep you informed about that. Now, things that caught my attention today. I see a new law and fine to combat the dangerous overtaking of cyclists will come into effect tonight. Transport Minister Shane Ross will today make it a distinct offence for a motorist to dangerously overtake a cyclist, increasing fines to €120. So road safety chiefs say drivers should give cyclists 1.5 metres of space when passing in zones with speed limits over 50 kilometres per hour and 1 metre where the limit is 50k or lower. So he's launching that new law today, which is good news. Of course, laws are fine and guidelines and rules are all fine, but if they're not enforced, do they mean anything? Because I know for a fact that there's a law that says that if you as a motorist, or I as a motorist, drive into a cycle lane. So say if you're coming out onto a main road and there's a cycle lane and you're coming perpendicular to it and you drive out and you block the cycle lane, that's an offence. So you get a penalty point on the offence and you get 3 penalty points on conviction. Now, how many times has anybody been caught doing that? No less convicted of doing that. I looked back in 2016, 14 people were caught for a full year doing that. And I see it every time I cycle. People sort of edging out onto the cycle lane, blocking the cycle lane and creating a very dangerous situation for the cyclists because they have to go around them, going out onto the road and into the line of oncoming traffic. Not oncoming, but traffic going the same way, if you know what I mean. So rules are great and laws are great, but if they're not enforced, they don't really matter. And people know that and they act accordingly. It was a great weekend for Liverpool fans, and they're talking about the winning the Premier League this year after beating Man City. And it was heartwarming to see pictures of Sean Cox at Anfield, to see his Liverpool team beat Man City. And you know Sean's story. He was beaten up by Italian fans on his way to a game last April. And we've had his wife Martina on the show, and there's been a number of charity events from over the years. Well, he got to meet Jürgen Klopp yesterday, and Jürgen said that Sean and Martina and the Cox family made him think of courage, spirit and renewal. And there's lovely pictures in the papers today. There's new alcohol laws coming in as in from today as well. A ban on alcohol advertising within 200 metres of a school, creche or local authority playground will be in place, not today, sorry, from Wednesday. It's all part of the Public Health Alcohol Act. Number of things happening, so that's one of them. Alcohol advertising in a cinema will be prohibited except around films with an 18 classification, that makes sense. And children's clothing that promotes alcohol will also be prohibited. So that's probably about, you know, sporting strips that have alcohol companies as sponsors, they're going to be banned. And then from the 12th of November of next year, that's all next year. One of the things that happened, hasn't happened yet and was supposed to happen was no alcohol advertising on TV before the watershed. And I was watching Ireland's Fittest Family last night on RTE and there in the middle of it, there was an ad for an alcoholic beverage, and it made me feel very uncomfortable because Ireland's Fittest Family is one of the few programmes on telly where you can sit down as a family and watch it. And it's promoting all the good stuff. Families together, families being active, competition, all of that. It's a very positive programme. And then in the middle of it, you have an ad for an alcoholic beverage. Just made me feel very uncomfortable. And the sooner that ban on advertising alcohol before 9 o'clock is in place, the better, I would think. Sign of the times, Patsy McGarry's article on the cover of the Irish Times today. Lay Catholics could soon officiate at ceremonies. Many Catholic weddings, funerals and baptisms will be conducted in Ireland in the years ahead by lay men and women due to a lack of priests, senior figures at Ireland's leading seminary have conceded. Reverend Professor Michael Mullaney, or could be Mullaney, he's the Pontifical University, sorry, he's the head of St. Patrick's College out in Maynooth. And he says, many ecclesiastical offices are open to lay people, but we haven't embraced it in Ireland. So things like whole range of pastoral outreach things that could be done, for example, funerals, weddings, they all could be administered by lay people. Of course, they can't celebrate the Eucharist or confession, but can do a lot of other things. That's interesting, isn't it? And I see that there are 33 seminarians out in Maynooth at the moment, and 28 of those are non-Irish, it says in the article there. They're from other countries, so only 8 of them are from Ireland. So if the Catholic Church is to survive in Ireland, they're going to have to get lay people involved in a big way. And people have been saying that for a long time and it hasn't happened, but it looks like it will happen shortly. 5155 on radio.rt.ie. Ree, Dara and Stephanie, that's how Alfie Bow was discovered. He was valeting a car, his job at the time, and singing away, and a music producer heard him, and the rest, as they say, is history, says Reg. And what about the overtaking of pedestrians by cyclists on footpaths? Sick of hearing about cyclists. What about pedestrians, the most vulnerable of all? Nothing. Well, I suppose we all have to be tolerant. Pedestrians, cyclists, motorists, bus drivers, truck drivers, taxi drivers, we all have to be tolerant and realise that there are other people using the space, whether it be a cycle lane or a footpath or a road. And all of those people are guilty along the way. I often think, because I cycle a good bit, that cyclists are on the bottom rung of the ladder. ladder, because even pedestrians stand out, they step out onto cycle lanes and they're there before you know it, because they're looking up and down and they're looking for buses and cars and trucks and they don't see the cyclist, and then they've stepped out and collision. Anyway, we just all of us need to be a little bit more tolerant and a little bit more patient and a little bit more observant when we're using the roads, and then it would make our roads a lot safer for everybody. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. REM, it's the end of the world as I know it. I feel fine. 51551. A lot of people don't like cyclists out there. In fact, all the people who texted into 51551 are giving out about cyclists. For example, this one, try driving down the bus lane in Harold's Cross in the morning. Cyclists are five abreast. It's like the Tour de France. Well, cyclists shouldn't be sharing a lane with buses. That's planners' fault, isn't it? In Scotland, you pass a cyclist as if it is a vehicle. In other words, when safe to do so, you cross over the line in the middle of the road and pass, as it should be. And of course, there are people who do wrongs. There are poor drivers, there are dangerous drivers, there are poor cyclists, there are dangerous cyclists. There are drivers who don't pay attention to cyclists, and there are cyclists who don't light up, particularly this time of the year. And it makes me feel very angry, because they give the rest of us a bad name. So they're no high-vis vest or jacket, they don't have any lights on their bike, and actually they go out of their way to become invisible. It's like they want to be a stealth bomber. You know, black bikes, all black, black helmets, the whole lot. I'm speaking both as a cyclist and a motorist, says this person, Rosemary. I cycle to work as often as possible. The remaining time I have to drive. I feel that the new law is great, but that there should be another law that says that if there is a cycle lane, then the cyclist must use it. Nutgrove Avenue was narrowed to provide cycle and bus lanes. Remaining car lanes are very narrow, but cyclists refuse to use the cycle path. Very frustrating as a driver. That's Rosemary, who sees it from both points of view. It's like what was that the musical about the cow guys and the something guys? Why can't they just get along? Why can't the cyclists and the motorists just get along? Because it's a perennial argument, isn't it? Motorists giving out about cyclists and cyclists giving out about motorists. And a lot of the blame, I think, is with the planners. Because a lot of cycle lanes, there's a new cycle lane up near Tom's school there. And it's lovely, it's great, and it's wide, and it's newly tarmacked, and there's lovely white lines, and the painting of a cycle. It's all lovely. And then it just stops. So you're cycling along, and then suddenly you're delivered out into the middle of the road. And that's common all over Dublin. I don't know what's like in the rest of the country. You're coming along, and you're cycling on a cycle path, and then you're delivered into this busy junction, and there's no, you know, rhyme or reason to it. There's no lines to tell you should be here, there, or anywhere. You're on your own. You're on your own, mate, there. And that's it, anyway. Let's try and get along. It's Monday. 51551, ray@rte.ie.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for text. Now, Aisling Gannon joins us in Studio 10. How are you doing, Aisling?
Hi, how are you, Ray?
Good. Aisling's son is 11 years old. Steve was born a female, but has identified as a boy since he was 2.5 years old. Since the time Steve could speak, he's been consistent, insistent and persistent that he's a boy. They're your words.
Yeah. Yes, they are.
Just last week, Aisling was honoured as a 2019 LGBT plus ally role model in recognition of her work on diversity and inclusion as a partner at Evershed Sutherland Law Firm, and that was a global award. She has spoken in her workplace about why, as the parent of a transgender child, it is important to break down barriers. Thanks so much for coming in, and we'll talk more about the award in a moment. But first, to get your story and Steve's story, how many children do you have?
I have two kids, Ray.
Two?
Like you.
Yes. And Steve is the youngest?
That's correct, yes. He's 11.
He's 11, right. And he's an older...
He has an older sister, Surika, who's 13, who, as I was just mentioning, is a little bit self-conscious at this stage in her life, so she's not so happy I talk too much about her, but he's delighted I talk to you about him.
Okay, but it's not her story, it's Steve's story, although she is part of it.
She's a great sister.
So when Steve was born, you were two girls, that was...
So as Steve said to me not that long ago, I thought I had two girls. He says he was always a boy, I just thought I had a girl.
Uh-huh.
But yes, he was christened with a girl's name. We were rearing him in what we thought was a gender-neutral house, but I thought I had two daughters, yes.
Right. And why did you decide to have a gender-neutral house?
I suppose I was brought up in a house where I had great parents who encouraged us to be anything we wanted to be. We were three girls and then a boy. I didn't feel there was any difference between us. But all my life, I felt there was no need for gender stereotypes. I went to college. I worked. I wanted to work. My mum always worked. It just wasn't... it was a conscious decision we made to have it sort of a gender neutral house. So my older girl, when she was born, by the time she could walk and talk, she was the dancing queen, as her granny called her. She was pink, she was sparkly. And the second kid came along and wasn't.
But Sorka gravitated towards that just naturally.
Naturally, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And you, when you say it was, I'm just interested to know what a gender neutral house would be. You know, so
all gifts. We didn't look for... So there were certain family members who might give sort of high heels and sparkly tops, etc. And I sort of veered away from those sort of things. So it was balls, bricks, playing outside, encouraged to get dirty, yes, you know, rough and tumble. And their dad was really keen on that too. So that was really...
And the nursery wasn't painted any particular colour?
No. Sorry, there was a time when she wanted pink things in her room, etc. Okay. But otherwise things were neutral.
Neutral, okay.
So we tried.
Okay. So then Steve comes along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as young as Steve was 2.5, we were doing hand-me-downs. And as you might remember, in your house or in other houses, there were hand-me-downs. Thought I had two girls. So there was the hand-me-down swimming togs, the hand-me-down Knicks when we were doing toilet training. And we started having tantrums at that stage.
Two and a half.
Would not wear the hand-me-down swimming togs or Knicks. And that's really when it all started to come out. And I remember one sort of meltdown, we were going swimming. And I said, get your swimming togs on. You want to go swimming? You really like swimming. Will you come on? He said, no. And he wanted to wear a pair of what we call shark shorts. So they were like swimming shorts,
yes,
that you'd wear maybe with a T-shirt top. And I was saying, just put the swimming togs on. Will you come on? Let's go.
So you were off in a girl's bathing,
yes,
suit.
Yeah. Exactly. An all-in-one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he had a meltdown and... You know, when you remember these moments in your life, he was having a bit of a meltdown. He was sort of under the bottom bunk of his bed and I'm on the ground leaning under the bottom bunk of the bed. And he said, he goes, well, this isn't me. You know, my privates are wrong. When will I get the right privates? Slightly different language to that. And I did not know what to do. And I remember calling his dad and saying,
right,
can you help me here? And I did not know what to say. And so fairly shortly after, I remember ringing the GP and saying, you know, not sure what this is about. And he said, well, I'm not sure either, but it's not utterly unheard of. Let's go and see somebody. So we went to see a local, I think, psychotherapist is the phrase, and she indicated that she thought it was a gender identity crisis. It was probably a phase, but to go with it, not to sort of quash it in any way. And her advice was to sort of keep doing what we had been doing and maybe allow a bit more openness, which was to go to, for instance, shops that sold girl and boy clothes, stand in the middle of the shop and say,
What do you want?
Instead of going into a boys' shop or a girls' shop. And consistent, insistent and persistent. In around that time, he was playing a lot with his older sister. And I was sort of more live to things and concentrating more. If they were doing role plays, he'd be the uncle, the brother or the dog. And would not role play in a girl's role, didn't identify with girl things. At this stage, he was... hadn't yet turned 3, I don't think, and he had a bike with no stabilizers and he used to wear these all-in-one dressy-up outfits like Spider-Man or Superman. And he'd be cycling on this little camouflage bike along the seafront and there was nothing about him. I remember, you know, everyone used to say, God, he's gorgeous, isn't he,
yes,
great? And everyone just thought he was a boy.
And just the private, so he would have seen his dad, yeah, had, you know, genitals.
And his cousins, yeah.
Right.
And he didn't. His cousins, and he knew his cousins were younger than him.
Had them.
And theirs had arrived, as he called.
Had arrived, right.
Yeah.
And his hadn't arrived.
Yeah.
Right.
At 2.5.
It's because it's very young, isn't it? Because I don't have a memory from 2.5.
Neither do I. I'll be honest, the only memories I have from, that, you know, anything remotely close to childhood are from photographs, I reckon.
Yeah.
But in this, you know, the equivalent of the parent PhD that you do when you find yourself in a new world like this. Apparently gender is set in our minds between ages 2 and 4. The theory of that is there.
Right.
And apparently if he had an MRI of his brain, he's likely to have a brain that looks like a boy's brain rather, yeah, than a girl's brain.
So when you went to the psychotherapist and they said that it's you know, it's a gender identity crisis, what can you remember what you thought?
I remember thinking, actually, to be honest, I remember thinking, geez, I'm glad there's a name for that. Or I'm glad that's a thing. That, you know, it's nothing to be wondered about or worried, you know.
Yes.
And I was really grateful for a bit of direction, to be honest. And there were one or two people in our lives at times that said, ah, that's a load of nonsense now. Would you put her back in the dress? And I said, well, she never wore the dress anyway, so I'm not putting her back in any dress. And it just gave a bit more freedom. But I remember there was a little bit of wondering, but I remember thinking, we'll just see how this goes. It's probably a phase.
This is sort of 8.5 years ago.
Yes.
And the conversation around transgender hadn't begun really in the public sphere, had it?
Certainly it wasn't in my life,
no.
Ray, I'll be honest.
No. Yeah.
And really it wasn't until he was 7. I remember sitting at a computer, and as a parent, I'm on this show telling a story against myself. I thought I was open-minded. I thought I was, you know, liberated. I thought I was, you know, in touch with what was going on. I did not know what I was looking up. I did not know what to look for. And I know that I had people around me who were probably trying to help me, but I was stuck in this, it's a gender identity crisis. You know, we'll see how this goes. It's a phase. And I was quite happy to go with it. It wasn't that I was stuck for it or against it or whatever. But I wasn't locked in it at all. But I remember going online to find somebody to talk to, and I didn't know where to start or where to look. And honestly, I did not know what the T of the LGBT stood for. I had heard the phrase. I'd probably used the reference many times. And I got in touch with TENI, the Transgender Equality Network of Ireland. And there were two people there I spoke to at different stages. And as I've said to them since, they caught me when I was falling. I did not know what to do. I didn't know that this was something I could work with, that was something I should work with. I didn't know how to be a parent. Mm. I didn't know how to show unconditional love. I didn't know whether I was supposed to show leadership.
Sure, how could you? How could
no
you
No idea.
Yeah.
But you know yourself as a parent. You presume you're supposed to be at least half a step ahead of them. You know, sometimes we're making it up, but you expect to be half a step ahead of them, or you try to be. Whereas in this instance, I hadn't a clue.
Yeah.
Now, at this stage, he was really forceful about the fact that he had to change his name, cut his hair, etc.
Okay, so we've gone from 2 to 7 to change his name. So let's take it back a bit. So 2.5, fine, just, but then you're going into a school situation.
Yeah.
So what are the practicalities around that then?
So the practicalities around that, again, it was a sort of make it up as I go along. Got in touch with this. So he was going into the same school that his sister had been in. So I was able to get in touch with the school and say, would it be okay if he wears the boy uniform, as they used to call it, rather than the girl uniform. So it was trousers and a shirt and tie rather than a dress or a pinafore and a cardigan. And they said, yeah, no problem. So he went into school and he had this absolutely amazing teacher and made a gorgeous friend in the class. And it just so happened that his class were chosen to do a pilot Ashthorpe programme. So there was no seated areas, there were workstations. And he just opened up. He was quite quiet and reserved at the time. And he really became best friends with a little fellow in the class who had some special needs. And the two of them just looked after each other, and the rest of the class all rallied with them, etc. And so Steve didn't feel as different. He had gone through a phase of feeling quite different.
It was mixed school.
Yeah. Mixed school, mixed class. And he was intending.
And was there anything said?
Nothing.
No.
And when he was in, at the end of, I think it was at the end of senior infants, another parent spoke to me. And she's a lovely girl, still know her well. And she said, you know, Steve's a little bit like Brad and Angelina's child. You know, I think she may even have said they have a kid who's transgender. Went over my head.
Right.
I remember afterwards saying to her, you could have been a tip-off to me, but I didn't.
So you didn't, you weren't familiar with the term?
No, I don't. No. And I certainly didn't think that had anything to do with this.
Yes.
I honestly
because
thought that was an older.
Steve was still, and I know people who are transgender don't like to hear their
old name.
Yeah, their old name, right. So, but he was Steve still was still, still answering to that name.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And at the time, I used the phrase that he was a tomboy. But by the end of senior infants, he wasn't happy. He kept saying, tomboy's a type of girl. I'm a type of boy. And again, wasn't really sure what to do with that, so sort of fudged it. So by the time he was going into first class, this was becoming a much bigger issue. The summer he was going into first class, we were away on holidays, and we were holidaying in Ireland in Cork. And every single child he met, firstly, they spoke English. And so I was more aware of it. Whereas when you're in foreign countries and whatever, they don't even talk to each other, they just play, you know, they sniff each other. You look about my age, you'll do. Whereas by the time he was going into first class, he'd been on holidays in Cork. And the first thing every child said to him was, are you a girl or a boy? So there was something, kids.
And what was his answer?
He used to get really annoyed. And he'd say, my name is Sive, I'm a tomboy. And I remember him saying to me, I don't like saying that. And I don't like having to answer that question because I don't like what I have to say. And I remember thinking, well, this is tricky, but I'm not really sure what else to do.
And were you sad as a parent? Because, you know, as a parent,
sad for him.
You want to fix things, don't you? That's your immediate reaction. And it's an intuitive thing. You just want to fix things for your kid to make their world a better place. And here he was very unhappy.
Yeah. And he was, there was one night, I remember he came in to me and try not to get emotional myself. He came in to me and he said, I think I'm a freak, Mum. I don't think there's anyone else in the whole world like me. And I said, God, you're not, you know, I love you to bits. And, you know, and he goes, that's you, you're my mom. Of course you do. Mm. And he said, but I don't think there's anyone else like me. And I remember thinking, I don't really know what to do about this. And I remember starting thinking about the fact that he was in first class in school. And we were coming up towards a Christmas play and his teacher, and he had this absolutely gorgeous teacher and a fabulous SNA in the class. And we went in to meet her and she said, actually, I don't know what to do. He doesn't know what role to have in the play. The Christmas play. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I was giving out girl roles and boy roles. And he goes, what about me? I'm in between. He goes, you don't know where to put me. And he's standing in this class in front of her. And she said, I'll never teach like this again, because they used to have a girl Lena to come in from the yard or out to the yard, a girl Lena to go to the loo or whatever. And she goes, this poor kid isn't really sure what to do. So she could feel that it was becoming a bigger issue in his head. I could feel it was becoming a bigger issue at home. And it came forward one Monday night, you know, when the real conversations happen. I went to say goodnight to him and he says, Mom, I need to cut my hair and change my name. It's going to be fine. Text everyone in your phone.
What age was he?
Seven.
Seven. You see, what fascinates me is because a lot of people talk about outside influences.
I know.
You know, people go online and they Google something and then they're in a community.
In our day, MTV.
The community, but the community confirms things and maybe, you know, sort of heightens things.
Yep.
He'd never seen. Steve had.
He had never heard the phrase. He'd never, as he says afterwards, met anyone like him.
Yes.
He'd never. He thought he was the only person in the world, but he found his solution, and his solution was to cut his hair and change his name.
Right.
It was because he felt the only thing he had to change was other people's initial perception of him, and once he could change that, it would all be fine.
So, how did you react to that?
So I had a moment of parental brilliance, which was pure fluke, which was he said, text everyone in your phone right now and tell them.
Yeah.
I said, well, what if you, my moment of brilliance, and it was a fluke, was what if you decide to change your mind on the name? And he said, I won't. I said, but you could. So how about we don't do it today? And we just have a think about it for a few days and try it out at home for a few days and we see how it goes. And he said, all right. So I talked him down that particular evening. Following morning, he said, I've thought it through. I'm sticking with the name. I want you to tell school. I'm going to stay in the same school, but I'm going to go into the boys. The school he was in was becoming all girls or all boys in second class. So it was building in terms of a need to make changes. And he wasn't aware at this stage that I was on the hunt for an alternate school because I didn't want him to go into all boys or all girls. And so he came down, he goes, I have it all sussed. Don't worry about making the communion. I don't want to make my communion. And if I did, I'd be in the suit, but it's okay. And I'll be gone. And he had all these things.
Thought it all through.
That he'd obviously been troubling him for a while, which I thought had just been my parental overthinking it, you know. And he said, but this is how it's going to be. And this is the name. And I said, stick with it. So about 2 days later, we're slowly but surely speaking, you know, as parents to each other, to wider network of parents, etc. And he says, I'm a bit nervous about the name, because he'd gone for the name Sam initially. And he came home and he said, geez, Mum, you won't believe it. Sam could be short for Samantha.
Right.
And I said, yeah. And he goes, God, that was good thinking. Good thinking that I didn't tell everyone that it was Sam, because I better go for a different name. And then he came up with Steve. And he said, and it's Steve, not Stephen or not whatever. So it's Steve. And I said, yep. And I said, you know, do you want me to help you? And he said, no, you had your turn at giving me a name. This is my turn to give myself a name. And I said, yep, yeah, great, okay. So he chose Steve. And at that stage then, we started the slow process of engaging with the school, with sports, etc. Family, amazing. They're all out there, they're probably listening, and they've just been 100% amazing, blessed. School, wider, have all been fabulous people, but needless to say, they needed us to work with them and at their pace, which is totally understandable. And I think that was frustrating for a bit for Steve and a little bit tricky for us as his parents, who were trying to be his funnel and conduit of information. But ultimately, he changed his name,
changed his school?
So he didn't change his school. He transitioned in the school he was in.
Right.
Still in first class.
So when you say transition, this is what they call social transition.
Social transition, yes. And don't worry, I don't worry about the language too
much.
No, but... For those listening.
Yeah.
So I think it's called a social transition. And the social transition is where you go from having been known as, say, Sive, to being reintroduced to people as Steve and requesting that it be Steve and, as we now know, correctly called male pronouns, so he, him. So Steve, he, him. So the request was that the school wrote out to all the parents of the kids in his class, attaching a letter from us requesting that they respect his position, that he says he's always been a boy, he now wants to live as a boy, he'd like to change his name, and our request is that you respect his choices and we call him by that name, and that if you've any questions you raise them with us perhaps rather than with him. And we were just blown over by the kindness, the compassion, the loveliness we received. One parent actually wrote to me and said, they're not Irish and they don't speak Irish. They didn't know that Sive was an Irish girl's name. They just presumed Sive was a boy because they'd met him,
yes,
as far as they were concerned, you know, he seemed like a boy.
You said somewhere that, and this is a bit probably sexist of you, but you said that Steve's behaviour suited a boy more than a girl.
And this is where I'm more and more alive to it now. So when he was very gregarious, loads of energy, and, you know, used to come out of school like a coiled spring and just bounce out of school and bounce off walls and climb trees and kick balls, and then he'd be able to relax a bit. But society was much more forgiving when his name was Steve and he had a short haircut. There wasn't that same, and I mean out in public places in relation to running around a supermarket or sitting still in a cafe or it. And I fully accept my role in that, or my supposed protection of that, etc. So it was striking to me. It was striking.
Okay, so he's 11 now.
He's 11.
He has changed his name by deed poll.
Yes.
Well, you've done it for him. He couldn't do it because he was a minor.
He had to be physically there and he had to speak up for himself at the time, actually. Yeah.
And he's a passport in the name of Steve.
Yes.
But I was just looking at my, guys, I've that card passport. I was just looking at it today. It declares me as male.
Yes.
So what does it say on Steve's passport?
Good question.
Yeah.
We have a Gender Recognition Act, and we have fabulous legislation in Ireland, actually. But the Gender Recognition Act is only applicable to those who are age 16 and above. So as a result, there's no mechanism by which he can change his gender marker, it's called, on any of his state documents until he's 16. So one of the major reforms we looked for in the Gender Recognition Act, and there's been a big consultation process over the last 2 years, is to change that so that those under 16 do so with the consent of their parents or guardians, in the same way as you had would change health records, etc. So basically, you couldn't make it up. He was going on holidays, he was going to a family wedding in France, and his passport was going to expire and go out of date while he was in France, so we had to get a new passport. At this stage, he's living as Steve, he's his haircut short as Steve. And
he's dressing as a boy.
And in every respect, he looks and sounds like, and it's called passing. So he passes as a boy. And so we had to get a new passport. So we started the process, and I would take all day. It was overwhelming. It was such an enormous exercise. And I can totally understand and respect the, you know, for child trafficking and protection laws reasoning. There's a lot of good basis for it. But geez, it's a hard exercise. It was hard work. So we got the amended passport.
You work in law, so you have an advantage.
I would say not only do I have an advantage, I have an advantage because I have an office. I can read and write. I have access to a computer. I have people who can assist me in terms of getting things done. I would absolutely feel for people who don't have access to all those privileges as we had. So we were able to get a new passport, get a deed poll name change, then get a passport. But then I had to contact the Department of Social Protection, which is where he's lodged and registered as my child. And that links with the Department of Education I had to contact. I had to contact the Department of Health. I had to individually do all of those, because if you change your details with one government department, it's really important you do it with them all, so that you're not investigated and confusing things.
Yeah.
But for instance, in relation to the Department of Health, you have to contact each individual doctor. There is no, because we don't have recognition or were not linked in relation to PPS, etc. So there was a lot of work involved in that. But he is now registered everywhere as being Steve. But he is still, his gender marker is female.
F.
Yes.
Right. And that brings us on to, you know, the Tavistock Clinic in London. And up until, if you are transgender, you need to attend there, don't you, if you're Irish, because we
yes.
don't have a similar clinic here. But they come over, do they, and have
yes.
a sort of a pop-up clinic, do they?
Yes. Yeah. So so the Tavistock Clinic is, I gathered, the centre of excellence in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're actually really lucky, it's very close to us. And as an Irish solution to an Irish problem, as I might call it, the Tavistock Clinic work really closely with Our Lady's Children's Hospital in Crumlin. Mm. And what they have at the moment, and certainly what I'm aware of, so we apply through the Treatment Abroad Scheme as public patients. We were referred to Tavistock, and Tavistock, we went through the waiting list. So the major advantage we've had in all this is that Steve was able to articulate and speak to us at a very young age, in which case we were able to start this process at a very young age, because there are long waiting lists. So we get seen, or he gets seen, and we get seen in Crumlin. So the Tavistock team have, as you say, sort of pop-up clinics in Crumlin, and that's where we get seen. So at the moment, he has been through a process where he is assessed and reviewed, and it's what they call watchful waiting.
And watchful waiting for what?
So watchful waiting in terms of what his views are, what his persistent, insistent and consistent requests are, and watchful waiting in terms of puberty and onset of puberty.
Because that's a big thing, isn't it, in the life of a transgender person? Because you can, if you want, take hormone blockers, and they will stop the puberty process.
Female puberty.
Yeah, female puberty.
For Stevie.
Yeah, so Stevie won't develop breasts. So where are you? Because it's coming down the tracks, isn't
yeah.
it, in a hurry.
Well, if I talk in somewhat, you know, general terms rather
yes.
than about him. So basically what I've learned is that the changes to your body during the first 2 years of puberty are incapable of being reversed. So the change to the shape of your jaw, your hairline, your waist, they're changes that can't ever be undone. Mm. So what you do is you buy time so that the individual, what I would seek to do is to buy time until the individual is that bit older to make decisions for themselves. It's not making any changes that are irreversible.
Right, that was my question.
Big, exactly.
Yeah. So hormone blocking
is reversible.
Reversible.
So if Steve was to if any transgender person was to have hormone blockers for, say, 2, 3, 4 years, when you stop those blockers, if they determined 2, 3, 4 years older that this was no longer the way they wanted to go, you stop taking the blockers and you would resume a female puberty.
Because reading accounts and talking to people, gender dysphoria becomes nightmarish in the teenage years.
The connection, most of us who aren't that familiar with this, etc., and particularly when it's not in your house, wouldn't be aware of just how sensitive people are to the changes in their bodies. Most of us don't necessarily even reflect and remember during that period too much of our lives. But I think the reality for kids who are going through early onset puberty or puberty and who really start to feel a total disconnect with their body, the effect on not just their physical but on their emotional and mental health is just phenomenally damaging, or can be phenomenally damaging. And as a result, you want to be able to provide insights and opportunities and options to kids as they need them. So we're very lucky that we're in that plan and in that program to be able to provide those to them.
And I'd say at this stage you've met many parents of transgender children. And has Steve met transgender
yes.
women and men?
Yes.
He has?
Yes. So Tenny organise what they call a family weekend away, and it's usually in November. And we've been going for the last few years, and it is just phenomenal to meet other people. It is phenomenal to meet other parents. And as you can imagine, just meeting another parent who, the first year we went, I was really nervous, I'll be honest. Steve was telling everyone how excited he was. He couldn't wait to meet people like him. That's how he discussed it. We arrived, and I think I might have told you the story before, but we arrived and it was lashing rain, and I'm nervous about going in to meet all these people I've never met before, and they probably understand all of this and I don't, and all this, you know, internalising all this anxiety. And we go to get out of the car and his older sister says, "What if they think it's me?" And Steve says, "What if they do?" And we're standing in the rain and I have the bags and I'm thinking, and here's me internalising the mum questions, and I realise she's internalising
yes,
hers and he's internalising
yeah,
his.
Yeah.
So we all go to our first workshop the next day, and she comes out of her workshop and says, I learned something really important today. I learned that I am the rock that holds this family together. You need to be there for him, but I am the rock that holds us together. And he came out of his session and said, you know, actually, it's just amazing to meet people just like me, and they're all totally normal like me. And I came out of mine just saying, I'd been crying on the inside for about the entire session, because it was just so... It was so such a warm, compassionate hug to be around other parents who'd similar experiences.
And how much does he... He's 11 now.
Yes.
He obviously... He sounds like a very bright boy.
Yes.
Like he understood a lot from a very early age.
Yes.
So he... Have you spoken to him about hormone blockers and the future? And you have discussed that.
So one of the key things actually that was quite difficult. So you have to have discussions. So before he can even be... up for discussion with the clinical team, he has to be able to comprehend what puberty looks like for a girl, what puberty looks like for a boy, and what puberty looks like for a transgender girl with blockers. And he has to be clearly understanding and accepting of the reality and not the aspirational. So for instance, and if you can imagine, so this conversation started last year. Not many 10-year-olds are being asked to prepare and to study and to be quizzed on so that they have an understanding. But they were very clear with him directly in one-to-one chats that I'm on the periphery of, that really we can't progress this discussion until you are in a position to do that. So we came out from a meeting last year and he said, you're going to need to get me a book and I'm going to need to understand this, because I need to make sure that they understand, that I understand what puberty is going to look like and why this cannot happen to me. And I remember... I was quite emotional about it, and we came out and I said, okay. And he said, you're not to get me a book with any bits in it. And he reminds me, he's only 10, and that nearly broke my heart, I'll be honest. Yeah. I was thinking, gosh.
How do you feel as a parent? Because it is classified as an abnormality, isn't it? Gender dysphoria.
I'll be honest. What I try and do as a parent is separate out the theory from the reality. So, for instance, my folks and I will have at various stages said, it's hypothetically, it's a fascinating subject, you know, and I can see that. It warps,
what a fascinating conversation.
Yeah,
there you go.
It warps our minds to try, you know, and I'll be honest, as a lawyer, as fellow lawyers, it's mind bending, you know, it's hard to get your head around. But I think when it's in your family, when it's a person, and I suppose that's why we're having this conversation, personal stories help people to understand.
Yes.
This isn't just a theory. This isn't a parent thinking this is hip hop or something.
And it's not a choice.
It is not a choice. He is a person. He is a person who was born this way. He has found his voice and is able to help me, to help him, and help us all to understand.
Which brings us nicely onto your award. So within the workplace then, did you feel you needed to tell Steve's story, or were you asked to tell it?
There are sort of slightly two stages to that. I certainly didn't feel I wanted to, nor I needed to, nor I had to. But in 2016, we established a perspective group, which is our LGBT+ employee network. And Greg Louganis, the swimmer, came over to speak to us, and he spoke to us all about the concept of bringing your whole self to work. And there were lots of people who were really moved and really touched, and it was incredibly well received. And I came out and I bawled and thought, it would never have occurred to me to feel that I could, never mind should, tell my fellow colleagues. And the following morning, at the time Steve was transitioning, he transitioned in school, etc. And at the back of my mind would have been a concern as to, how do I go to the Christmas party, the panto, at the next Christmas and say, oh, you know the way you used to know X, but here's Steve.
Yes.
And it wasn't that it was a concern for me, but I would have been aware of it. So I told my team and work the following day, and the level of compassion was just phenomenal. Then I told a few of my partner colleagues, and it was, again, just phenomenal. But I started to feel the difference it made in me. So instead of feeling like I had to keep my outside world out of work and my inside world at home and keep the two entirely separate, I had my public and my private, there was this alignment. And the reality is that since 2016 up until now, there's this been alignment where my values and this bravery that my son has taught me, if I'm going to get real, as he says, and be real, you can't just do that at home. You have to be able to do that in work too. Mm. So last year, one of my colleagues in work, an incredible solicitor, Linda O'Neill, she stood up and told her story. And I was entirely moved. And she said, not many people have to come out to their entire offices. She said, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it in one standing. But she was so incredible and so inspiring. And people were so it reminded people why you don't know everything about everybody around you. And really, you shouldn't presume you do, but you should presume that they are who they are. So she turned to me and said, you have to tell your story. Or said, would you tell your story? And I said, nobody wants to hear my story. My story is the story of a mum. And she said, yeah, but an ally's story is really important because it's something you've had to learn. And as Steve says to me, you don't know how I feel. You only know because I tell you. Yeah. And she says the same thing. And actually, the voice of an ally, I have learned, can be, people may say things to an ally they would not say to a person. And we get to be in rooms, perhaps, where conversations can be influenced and supported. And that's where I have had to.
And that's why you won the award. And Steve has made you a better person.
100%.
It's fascinating. And David there says, what a fascinating conversation. A real eye-opening on a subject I have to admit I would probably qualify as being slightly ignorant about. And I'm sure you're not in your own, David.
Him and I both.
A very well-spoken lady, and I hope everything goes well for Steve and all his family. So
thank you so much.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for listening. Thank you so much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Now, Connor, sorry about the delay.
No problem.
Finally get to you. Now, dear Connor, I was waiting with interest for the launch of the new Cadbury chocolate bar, which is made with 30% less sugar, because we're hearing about how bad sugar is for us. I wanted to see how the new bar would stack up in taste terms, but it was the price which I noticed first. Irish shops have large bars of Cadbury's milk for sale at 150, while smaller bars with 30% less sugar cost 170. That's some difference.
Yeah, now first the context. Earlier this summer, Cadbury launched a dairy milk chocolate bar that was made with 30% less sugar than the original. And it was launched first in the UK, and the bar went on sale in the Republic of Ireland last month. Now, the new formulation was the very first change to the original dairy milk chocolate bar since it went on sale in 1905. So for the Cadbury's people, it was a big deal.
News.
And the reason why they were doing it was largely in response to a move by the UK government. And it's kind of being mirrored in this country as well, to reduce the sugar content of snacks and sweets by 20% by 2020. So there's a big move in the UK, as there is in this country, to get people to eat less sugar. So this was the Cadbury's response. They wanted to reduce the amount of sugar in their bars of chocolate by 30%. Now, the owners are a company called Mondelez, and they said that more than 20 scientists, nutritionists and chocolatiers had spent 3 years working on the revised formulation, which it described as, this is a quote, the most significant innovation in the brand's history. So that's the context under which this chap is sending in the email. So what they did, just they added more fibre to the bar to replace the reduced sugar content, and there was no artificial sweeteners added. And, you know, so the sugar content per bar in the new bar is 39 grams per 100 grams, while in the original it's 56 grams. So, you know, there's a significant drop in the sugar content. Now, there isn't actually a significant drop in the calorie content, but it's the sugar that they're kind of targeting. But that's all by the way, because what our listener was concerned about was the price. And as the prices were outlined by this person, the 53 gram bar of chocolate costs 150. Now that works out at just over 28 euros per kilo.
Right.
The 30% less sugar bar, on the other hand, weighs 35 grams and costs 170. Now that works out at more than 48 euros per kilo.
So the difference 48
so
versus...
it's 28 euros per kilo for the full sugar bar versus 48 euros per kilo for the low sugar bar. And like, you're kind of thinking, okay, well, I can see why there'd be added costs associated with getting all your crack team of nutritionists and Oompa Loompas and whatever it is that you have to make the new bar. But like, that should be a factor, a cost of doing business. Like, the consumer shouldn't really be expected to pay at the end just because you spent all this time investing in a new product. So I contacted the company, and they sent me a little bit of a spiel. In order to create the new Cadbury dairy milk, we have used new ingredients, technologies, manufacturing processes. Again, that's all by the way. That should be a cost of doing business, not something that the consumer should have to bear. And that, they said, that had to be taken into account when determining the price. And then talked about the low sugar strategies, which I've kind of said what they were, the whole plan were, and they wanted to make sure that the product was just right and everything was perfect. But again, none of the stuff that they sent me answered the question, which is, why was this bar that had 30% less sugar and weighed significantly less way more expensive than the full sugar bar? And then it emerged kind of almost as a by the way that, you know, they came back to me and said, well, we don't actually set the price in the shops. What we do is we have a recommended retail price for the bar of chocolate. And the recommended retail price of the 30% less sugar bar of chocolate is 130. So then it emerged that it's not Cadbury's that are charging the significantly higher price for the 30% less bar. it's retailers.
Right.
And Cadbury's, whilst, you know, they can't insist that a retailer charges a certain price. And I suppose the clearest example of the big change in pricing models in this country could probably be, I could use the example of Tato. Now, when I was a child, all Tato came with a little price logo on the bag, right?
Yeah, I remember
so it was
that.
Like you can almost tell how old somebody is by how much they remember a bag of Tato costing. So, do you remember it costing 3 pence? And there was people who remember with the old D at the end of it. So, 3 pence, 5 pence, 8 pence, whatever it might be. But then in the 1990s, the price tag mysteriously disappeared from Mr. Tato, and the reason was that retailers were demanding the right to charge whatever price they wanted for the bag of Tato. Mm. So they insisted that Mr. Tato got rid of the price tag.
Retailers feel that people who are conscious about their health and want less sugar in their bar of Cadbury's are willing to pay more.
Possibly. And that might be the example. Now, I can't speak for, because I mean, there would be no point in focusing on one particular retailer, because there could have been several that charged the higher price and then others would charge the lower price.
So you brought in samples of both.
I actually did. And this is going to be Radio Gold, Ray, because this is going to be Ray Darcy eating chocolate on the radio.
Right.
So there's two. I'm going to give you...
You know which is which.
I know which is which. Right, so I'm going to give you one first.
Yes, okay.
And then you can... So this is one. My hands are clean.
Okay.
There you go. So Ray Darcy is eating the chocolate now. I'll have a bite of that.
Yeah. I'm just going to drink some water there.
So that's chocolate bar number one. And this is chocolate bar number two. Now, can you tell the difference between those two pieces of chocolate?
Not really, but I think the second one is less sugar.
Is the wrong answer.
Right, there you go.
it's worked for them.
Mm.
It's worked for them in that they have, and I had just, because I didn't want to
there
be completely clueless coming in here, so I ate a bar of both bars of chocolate before I came in.
Of course you did.
And I struggled to tell the difference between the 30% less and the full
sugar.
So
we've learned that they've done a good job. You can have a chocolate bar that tastes similar, but with 30% less sugar. And they're not laying down the price.
No, and
retailers who are.
And I got a sense, now they didn't say this, and they'd be very careful not to say this, but I would imagine they're not happy in the same way that any company wouldn't be happy if an individual retailer prices their product that they've invested all this time and energy creating kind of out of the reach of people. Because people will look at the two things and they'll say,
Defeats the purpose.
That's 150, that's 170, that's big, that's small. I'm going to go with the big one that's cheap as opposed to the small one that's dear.
Well spotted, emailer, and good work, Connor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we've a lot to get through in the next 15 minutes. Today, RTE kicks off a week-long focus on climate change to coincide with Science Week. Tomorrow on RTE 1, a three-part series will begin. It's called What Planet Are You On? And it's presented by Maya Dunphy, and she's on Planet Earth and in Studio 10.
Hello, Ray.
Good
How are you?
Good afternoon, Maya. The show follows three families and looks at their daily lives in the areas of water waste, energy and food in their homes. Their habits are then evaluated by experts, and we have three of them on the show today. We have Brian Keller, who's a lecturer in environmental chemistry in DCU, and you're the bin man, you're the expert on waste, Brian.
Yes.
Good afternoon and thanks for coming into studio. We have Fiona Regan, Professor of Chemistry and Director of the DCU Water Institute. And guess what Fiona's an expert on? You've guessed it right. Water.
Hi, Ray.
I was going to say congratulations, Fiona, being an expert on water. You're very welcome to the studio. Thanks for coming in. And down in our Limerick studio, we have JJ Leahy. And JJ is Professor in the Department of Chemical Sciences at the University of Limerick. And his area of expertise is energy. Good afternoon, JJ.
Good afternoon, Ray. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming into our Limerick studio. Now, Maya Dunphy, you spotted straight away that Cadbury milk chocolate has...
It's full of palm oil. Yeah. That's my problem with not the sugar. I used to buy the big bars and just eat 30% less. That's how I took the sugar out. But it's full of palm oil, so that's the issue I have, which is obviously very damaging to the habitat of the orangutan, who was very close to my heart.
Now,
I'm also the least qualified person in this room. I'm not a professor, but...
No, but you're the presenter, so you have an overview.
Yes. Well, I'm the layperson, like our three families. And what I love about this show, Ray, is that it's, I think sometimes, and, you know, Fiona and Brian might not agree with me and JJ, the climate change discussion can feel so huge and so enormous and like, what can we possibly do? And this show, I think, brings it right down to a more micro level and makes it really accessible for people. And you know, our three families, we have the McKevitts, the Cullens and the Gannons. They really embraced this challenge across the four categories: water, waste, energy and then food and diet. So I think if people watching can take even one thing from what one of the families have learnt, you know, if we all make these small changes, they can amount to a big difference.
And I think they'll be looking at the programme as I was today and saying, oh, we do that. And then when Brian or Fiona or JJ gives them a hard time over that, then you feel a bit guilty at home. You might change your behaviour.
Yeah. They laid themselves bare, because I wouldn't want the nation seeing the mistakes I make behind closed doors. I mean, would you guys? Because we all do it.
That's the phrase. The phrase, which is hugely important there, is behind closed doors.
Yes.
Because all our activity around water and waste and eating is behind closed
doors. I wouldn't let Brian look through my bins, put it that way.
Well, Brian, I'd love to. Seeing as Maya brought you in, Brian, to the conversation, so you will be forever known now after this week as the bin man.
Yeah.
So what you did is you went through the McKevitts, the Gannons and the Cullens bins, and you told them what was right and what was wrong. What are the main mistakes that people make?
The main mistake, I'd say, is putting organic or kitchen waste into the black bin.
Right.
And then maybe mixing up your recyclables. So you're turning it from a possible win-win situation into a lose-lose situation. If you put the organic into the wrong bin, that will end up in the atmosphere probably as carbon and as a greenhouse gas. However, if we treat it properly, we can use it then as a very valuable addition to soil or a biofuel or something like that. So we're not just losing something by putting it into the wrong waste cycle. We're actually polluting and we're...
And don't take Brian's professional calm demeanour. I mean, he's an amazing man, but he was the toughest man to impress, wasn't he, Fiona?
He really was tough.
Was,
he really said
And he would come up with his tongs in his lap and go through recycling, the general bin, the food waste bin, and he left no piece of recycling unturned.
Do you think that people don't know enough about what happens after they put the stuff in the bin?
Yeah,
like, if they understood what the process was, then they might...
Yeah.
They do a better job of it.
The great thing in the last year or two, you can see the awareness has increased so much. Without any doubt, something has clicked out there. So people are now more interested. And that's the first thing. You have to have an interest and you have to have a will. So that's getting there, although we still have a lot of challenges. So it takes an effort for us all to do our waste properly at home. But then it is complicated by rules and regulations that are fairly haphazard. There's no standardisation. The rules are quite different as you go around the country. Even the bin colours are different. So that doesn't help the ordinary person. It gets complicated. And there are several layers of dysfunction, you can nearly call it, or challenges with the whole waste industry in Ireland. We're just not dealing with it. Individually, we have to make an effort, but also as a country, we have to have policies there, and we have to have guidance for those of us that are working in these areas where we're trying to add value to waste. Because remember, we shouldn't think of it as waste. It's not waste. This is valuable material that we're wasting.
You haven't seen my bins.
Did you? You actually learned something from the program.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was it about soft plastics?
Oh well, you see, I'd be as I like convenience as much as anybody, and I'm always being given out to at home for my, you know, I haven't put the right things into the bins either. So I was learning myself. I mean, my background would be in the organic matter and trying to add value there, but absolutely learned. But the families were great too. I mean, you know, if they're an example of what we can do in Ireland, we're in a good place.
Yeah, poor Jason McKevitt was burning everything in the front room fireplace.
Yeah, so I mean, he was tipping his bin into the fireplace and burning it.
Yeah.
And I joked to Brian saying, well, maybe he's just cutting out the middleman, because we filmed our studio setting, in inverted commas, it was in the incinerator in Ringsend, the Dublin Waste Energy Plant in Ringsend, which is, it was quite stark. It was a revelation being there.
Just before I leave this, is it true that soft plastic shouldn't be put in the recycling bin?
It is, funny enough, and it's counterintuitive, because we should be able to recycle.
We've been doing that wrong.
Yeah. Well,
wrongly, I should say.
Yeah, you see, this is one of the things that's confusing. We can recycle soft plastics. The problem is that they interfere with the recycling processes that are now,
right,
that we now use.
Take that away. That's an interesting one. JJ's down in our Limerick studio. JJ, on electricity... a lot of the families were using what you would think is far too much electricity.
Well, I would say compared to our European counterparts, Irish families typically use about 30% more than the German or the Dutch, which is surprising when you consider that electricity in the Netherlands costs probably 60% per unit of electricity that we pay. So the Dutch pay less, but they also use less.
Are their houses more energy efficient? Is that it?
If your house is more energy efficient, it generally means you use less heating rather than electricity.
Right. Okay.
I think some of it is just convenience. Like I would say the most guilty party that I could see in these families, and it also reflected my own house, and that is that we probably wash clothes too frequently in Ireland. We want to freshen them up. And what allows us to do that is not the washing machine, it's the tumbler dryer, because it's so convenient to dry them. Whereas when I was a young lad growing up, you know, your clothes were dirty before you washed them because they had to be hung out in the line you could dry them.
And JJ, the tumble dryer uses an awful lot of electricity.
Compared to other household appliances, yes.
And you suggest in the programme that people use their washing machines and tumble dryers when there's less electricity being used around the country.
Exactly.
Cheaper then, or what?
It should be cheaper. So, in fact, it is. So if you have an electric vehicle and you will be encouraged to go on the nighttime rate, which is significantly cheaper than the daytime rate. And if that is the case, then you should also use as many other appliances and benefit from that cheaper rate. A colleague of mine who was a very early advocate of electric vehicles, he told me recently that his electricity bill has not increased by a single cent since he bought his electric vehicle and switched to nighttime electricity.
So he charges it at home as opposed to one of those charging stations around the country, which they're going to charge for from this month.
But he also switched his other appliances. So his washing machine, his tumbler dryer, his dishwasher are used at night.
And one of my colleagues pointed out, because he works in an apartment complex, that if everybody in an apartment complex put on their tumble dryers and washing machines at night, that it'd be hell for everybody. Just the other thing is, because we're getting to Fiona here, but before we get to her, showers. There's one young lady in the programme who had a shower that lasted 23 minutes.
I think that was absolutely phenomenal. And I suppose people don't realise the cost. Electric showers, they tend to be 9 kilowatts. So if you think of your electric kettle, it's probably 1.5 kilowatts. So your shower is using three times the amount of electricity that your kettle is using. And yet she left it on for 23 minutes.
How long should a shower be, do you think?
Probably 4.5 to 5 minutes.
Right, 4.5.
Poor Nicole Cullen. We really need an electric dryer. Lots of people are doing it, I'm sure. This is the point that we're all going to learn from this show.
Yes, Fiona. So, of course, as well as electricity, a shower uses water.
That's for sure.
How did the three families do on water?
Well, you know, they did extremely well. They started out pretty bad.
Spoiler alert. Don't give us away the ending.
Well, you know.
So what mistakes were they making at the outset?
You heard about the shower time. That was real. We had a over 20-minute shower. That's not unusual. You know, any families with teenagers are out there will really relate to this. But the improvement that happened over the course of the 3 weeks was incredible. Mm. Things like shower times came down to 5 minutes. Things like, you know, the flush in the toilet, which can use up a lot of water, the numbers of flushes, all these.
So what's your advice around flushing? We all have to go.
And you have to flush.
It all gets a bit scatological.
No. I won't lie. Yes, I know, but you see, it is the minutiae of it, isn't it?
My husband would kill me if I said, don't flush. You know,
on what? On a number one. Don't flush on a number one. Only flush on a number
toilet,
two.
Flush the toilet, guys. It's okay. I'm not saying don't flush here.
Right.
But
there's small things, Phil, that you tell me about. You know, the half flush button that most modern loos have.
Yes.
Most people just squash down the whole thing. You use twice the water using the
So do
the
a half flush.
Yeah.
And would you be advising, no, I'm serious about this, would you be advising not to flush on a number one and flush on a number two?
No, I wouldn't. I personally wouldn't be advising that. I mean, there's health and safety.
The other thing is that people do. The other thing that people do.
Unless you've done a poo, don't flush the loo.
There you go, and it rhymes. The other thing is that people leave the tap running when they're brushing their teeth.
That goes through me.
People leave the tap running when they're rinsing off. And you say don't rinse off to put into the dishwasher.
Well, you know, you can wipe off.
Wipe off, don't
rinse
off.
Absolutely, yeah. Why waste water? You can wipe off and put it into your
toilet
little brand bin.
Oh, no, we're not. Okay.
So here's the thing, and I've said it over and over again, that people feel that they're such a small little cog in the whole planetary climate change thing that why bother? You know,
this is why we would encourage everyone to watch this show, because like I said, everyone, and we put it into quite interesting comparisons in the show of what the equivalent of this might be in flights and long driving. Mm. And so I think if people watch the show, they will see how really small changes on a much bigger level, if we all make them, can make a huge difference. And it's not sanctimonious. There's no finger wagging here. It's look, we all do this.
Yeah. Brian, back to you just on the brown bin, because you said to one of the families, it's mad that you're not using the brown bin.
Yeah. They thought that they were saving money by not using the brown bin. And that's, again, because the rules have been confusing and rules have changed down through the years. So they were paying, putting all their organic material into their black bin or their residual waste bin, and thinking that they were saving money, and they weren't.
They weren't.
No.
And what about compost heaps, or what did they call them? Compost?
Compost heaps or compost containers. Units, yeah. Yeah, that's something. It's like, you know, the compo culture. It shouldn't be compo, it should be compost culture now.
But because one of the families...
We all need to be...
But one of the families said that they used to have a compost heap, but it attracted rodents. I think it was the Gannons from Galway.
Yeah. That's their fear, and that would be a lot of people's fear, and that's a genuine fear. Now, there are ways around that. If you leave organic material out over 2 years, it's going to compost very slowly. It'll take a few years, but there's ways of hurrying it up.
Okay.
But it can attract rodents if you don't do it properly. So it's not straightforward.
No.
It's not
straightforward.
No, but the brown bin should, if everybody has a brown bin, then they put all the material in there and somebody takes it away. And then
you get a cat.
The encouraging thing I think I took away from this is that a lot of this change has been driven by young people. That the teenagers and the young adults in the TV programme are encouraging their parents to change. And that's
absolutely. We could see that in all cases. It was the teenagers, as you said, the adolescents and the younger people who are driving their parents to change. And I would say that probably reflects what happened with the Green Flag program in school.
Yes.
When children started to pick up rubbish, when children started to recycle, they brought it home as well.
Of course, so, Greta Thunberg as well.
Exactly.
Maya, tell us when it's on. Tomorrow night starts.
It's
tomorrow
on
night.
Tomorrow night, RT1, 7 o'clock, and for three consecutive, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this week.
What
7
planet
o'clock,
are you on?
RT1. What planet are you on? You will learn a lot, Ray. Please tune in.
JJ and Lemmy, thank you very much. Thanks very much, Brian. Thanks, Fiona, and Maya Dunphy. Thank you. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Monday.